This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The following program is homecrafted and was recorded on June 10th, 2021. Quote, "What it's like to house hunt in one of the craziest markets in the country," end quote, was one of the headline stories last week on CNN's business webpage. The city in question was our very own Austin, Texas. According to one statistic in the news report, home prices are up more than 40% since last April, while inventory of available properties is at one of its all-time lows. These statistics, on top of a steadily growing influx of new residents to this area, has created an affordable housing crisis never before seen in this city. It goes without saying that low-income individuals and families are the segments of the population hardest hit by this trend. Finding places to live that are within their reach financially is akin to finding a needle in a haystack for many, leading some to the brink of homelessness or worse. Miraculously, there are some bright spots to be had. Some examples include the affordable housing developments built and managed by local nonprofit organizations such as Foundation Communities and Mobile Loaves and Fishes. The housing complexes and planned communities run by these foundations provide much-needed housing to individuals and families in the lowest income brackets, those who may be coming out of homelessness, or for people who may need temporary housing assistance in order to get back on their feet financially. Unfortunately, it will take substantially more inventory in order to meet the staggering demand, something the organizations continue to address through the addition of more planned developments set to open in the near and more distant future. But it is an uncertain future for this crisis at best. As the executive director of Foundation Communities, Walter Moreau, simply put in a recent interview with local TV station KXAN, quote, "Austin is not a small town anymore. If we want it to be an affordable place to live, we have to create more affordable housing and supportive housing to take care of all of us," end quote. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin and streaming live at coop.org. I'm Michelle Manning-Scott, guest hosting the program this evening alongside regular host Bob Daly and our frequent guest commentator Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project. Our guest this evening is John Henneberger, co-director of Texas Housers, a private nonprofit organization dedicated to providing information about housing and community development issues in Texas. One of the main goals of Texas Housers is to support low-income Texans' efforts to achieve a decent, affordable home in a quality neighborhood. Welcome to the program, Mr. Henneberger.
Thanks, Michelle and Bob and Jim, and call me John.
Well, we usually start out our program by having our guests introduce themselves and give a little bit of their background. So if you want to jump in and do that, we can start off that way.
Okay, well, I'm John Henneberger. I'm the co-director, along with Karen Popp, of the nonprofit Texas Low Income Housing Information Service. We go by the name Texas Housers because that's kind of an unfortunately long and tongue-twisting name. We've been around since 1988. We're headquartered here in Austin, but we have offices in San Antonio and Houston. I have 14 people working in our organization. We are started off primarily as an advocate for community-based solutions for the affordable housing crisis for low-income people. By advocate, I mean we were there to push for more government support for democratically directed, community-based solutions to affordable housing. That is to say, advocacy at the community level against evictions and programs that didn't get the housing to poor people and advocacy to get money directed to grassroots nonprofit groups that were accountable at the neighborhood level to build more affordable housing. And we've gradually moved to have an increasing role in civil rights and fair housing aspects of affordable housing, primarily directing our work toward government agencies and large developers who don't do right by low-income people and communities in the use of affordable housing funds.
And what brought you into founding this organization? Where were you coming from prior to this? I guess in the 80s, you said.
Yeah, well, in 1975, I was literally coming from the University of Texas at Austin as a sophomore studying history. And I was directed by a couple of professors who later became mentors to go out and collect oral history interviews in an African-American freedmen's community called Clarksville in West Austin back then. And Clarksville was at the time 100% African-American community with unpaved roads, no public sewer, had a lot of housing conditions, but it was a incredibly valuable and rich community where four generations of African Americans had built homes and a church and a few little businesses and other things. And they were under attack. I soon found out when I went out to start collecting oral history interviews, they had been partially decimated by the State Highway Department's construction of the Mopac Expressway, which shaved off the western third of the community. And the city of Austin at the time was proposing to build a crosstown expressway, which would go down 15th Street and then jog a little south and run the length of the Clarksville community, eliminating the rest of it. So when I went out to Clarksville as a 19-year-old to try to talk to elderly people in the community about the history of the community and the like, the community was just in an existential struggle for survival. And folks told me, we really don't have time to do oral history interviews with UT students. And so I had the foresight to ask the question, well, is there something I can do to help? And the community board, which was elected by the residents of the neighborhood, the leader of that group, a woman named Mary Frances Baylor, asked me if I could go down to the city and look into the plans for the Crosstown Expressway, that maybe I could get some information that they had been unable to get because I was a student and a white kid and wasn't as threatening. And so I went down there and got information and just found their struggle to be incredibly important and inspiring. And I ended up sort of quasi dropping out of UT, although I eventually got my degree, and volunteering in the Clarksville community as basically a research aide to the community leaders in the community. And from there, we went on to set up one of the first community development corporations in Texas, built some affordable housing units, defeated the Crosstown Expressway. The neighborhood got together and organized politically and defeated the Crosstown Expressway in a weird sort of alliance with their white neighbors in the other neighborhoods that surrounded the African-American community of Clarksville. And so we went on and wrote a grant and built six little affordable housing units that were community owned. And Clarksville prospered for a while, eventually got gentrified out of existence a couple of decades later. Well, decade and a half later, I guess I'd say. But from there, I went to do similar work with some other communities in Austin, both Hispanic and African-American communities. And then eventually found myself with Karen Popp, the other co-director of Texas Housers. We set up Texas Housers to be an advocate for community-based solutions to the problems of affordable housing and government discrimination against poor people of color and poor neighborhoods of color.
So back in the 70s, did you ever imagine that you'd be living in the least affordable city in the state?
Now, in the 70s, Austin was quite a different place. You know, in high school before then, in the late 60s and the early 70s, I'd come down here because it was kind of a cool place to hang out. It was sort of famous for being a fairly affordable place to live. And there were a lot of people, mainly a lot of white folks, who could kind of be slackers and hang out here and find affordable housing prices. I guess I wasn't, when I first came to Clarksville, I really wasn't aware of the dynamics of the real estate market and the way it was affecting the African-American and Hispanic communities in the city. It was going on without me being aware of it, but there were aspects of the exploitation of those communities by commercial real estate interests and white investors that was causing displacement even back then. But it just looked to me at the time in the early 70s, in the mid 70s, like a really kind of laid back, affordable place to live.
Yeah, it was the hippie mecca, as I recall. I grew up in Dallas. And so first time I came to Austin was like 1977 as a kid and barely remember that. Just coming to see the Capitol, of course, like all the Texas elementary school students would do. But that's amazing to me because I do know some of the history of Clarksville from like way back at the turn of the century, it's the turn of the 1900 century. I had no idea that Clarksville remained as disconnected to the rest of the city up until the 70s. So that's amazing history. Jim or Bob, did you know about that?
Yeah, of course. I've heard about it. This is a little bit before my time. I was in South Texas, but I really like hearing this history because it's recent. And I think it's really important for us to understand this oppressive gentrification has gone on much longer than we have given it credit, or discredit, I should say.
So, John, how did Clarksville survive the 1928 segregation plan?
Well, it was impacted by the Couch and Fowler plan. You know, the plan, for people who don't know, it was part of the progressive movement of city planning. From progressive really was pretty much equated with racism. The plan called for the consolidation of all publicly financed amenities for African Americans to be restricted to East Austin. Let me back up. The 1929 master plan and that whole effort has gotten a lot of attention, and deservedly so, but there are a lot of other dynamics, I think, that are equally important that have created the displacement, and not just displacement, but the wholesale diaspora of the African-American population out of Clarksville to Pflugerville and the surrounding suburbs. If you indulge me for a minute in that history, at the time of the Civil War in 1860, 38% of the Travis County population were slaves, which is the largest population of African-Americans that ever lived in this place. Upon emancipation after Juneteenth and federal troops moved into Texas and forced whites to end involuntary servitude of blacks, the African-American population in Austin actually grew even more for a short period of time as African-Americans came to Austin as the state's capital to try to both exercise freedom by getting off the plantation and to make connections with relatives who had been sold away during the slavery years. And so there was a development of a lot of African-American communities around Clarksville. The existing African-American population from the county and from the city, well, the city population was heavily integrated within the white community. There were servants' quarters behind houses, and the urban slave population was really not segregated into a quarter of the city, but it was really integrated within the city as a whole. Integrated not in an economic sense or in a social sense, but integrated in terms of a sense of physical proximity. So when all this African-American population began to consolidate in the state's capital city, looking for how to exercise freedom and how to reunite with people who'd been sold away, people needed a place to live. And a whole series of communities were founded by African-Americans on the periphery of the city of Austin, which is in areas that today we think of as like inner city Austin, but communities like Clarksville, which is near West Lynn and 10th Street, near Mopac and 10th and 11th and 12th Street. Communities like Wheatsville, which had its center point at 24th and San Gabriel Street. Communities like Kentonville and Masontown. And there were like 16, 17 different African-American settlements where the African-American population moved. And they moved there essentially because whites would tolerate blacks to continue to live near them in the city if they lived in servants' quarters or lived in a servile type of condition. And many did, because that was the only form of employment that was open to people. But there was this large number of additional people coming in, and they needed someplace to live. And community leaders emerged in the African-American community, people like Charles Clark and Jacob Fontaine, who founded Wheatsville and who edited the first African-American newspaper west of the Mississippi River. And that newspaper, by the way, was primarily a vehicle for publishing advertisements where former slaves would inquire through the newspaper, my sister so-and-so was sold away from me in Montgomery, Alabama in 1858, and I'm looking to reunite for her, and I can be found through the offices of the Gold Dollar, which was the name of Fontaine's newspaper. But anyway, African-American churches became one of the first institutions which was established in each of these satellite African-American communities, which literally encircled the city of Austin. And preachers became prominent community leaders and the like. I think this is interesting because when we think about gentrification and displacement, you know, we need to understand that the African-American community responded initially in that post-Civil War era with actually making a decision about where they would live. And they wanted to live here in the area around Austin, but they were at the time restricted. They could not live in the city itself. They were not allowed to live there unless they continued to work in servile positions, but they could form communities and live in these outlying areas. And they did. And that's how Austin's population existed. There was no East Austin or area known as the Black Ghetto in Austin. There were instead these freedmen's towns scattered around the city where Black people had the agency to actually found and develop their own communities. But what began to happen in subsequent years, moving into the 1890s, the 1900s period, and really accelerating after 1900, was the rapid growth of the city of Austin. You know, the addition of Hyde Park and the South Austin subdivisions that occurred, the city began to grow out, and the University of Texas also began to grow, which put pressure on the Wheatsville community and some of these other communities. So we had the white population in Austin growing and bumping against the Black population in these satellite communities. And you then begin to see a whole series of actions on the part of the city, coercive and restrictive actions, which were designed to remove those Black satellite freedmen's towns from existence in order to make way for the expansion of white Austin over those areas. So all of that stuff predates the 1929 master plan. So the 1929 master plan is really sort of a latecomer in the segregative public policy which created apartheid here in our city. And it's important to keep in mind that it wasn't just government action like the 1929 master plan represents, where they said, if you want to go to school and you're Black, you have to go to East Austin. If you want to go to the library and you're Black, you have to go to East Austin. If you want to go to a park and you're Black, you have to go to East Austin. Well, that was the public facilities part. But for decades before that, the real estate community, the investment community were actively engaged in using property tax policy and manipulation of deeds and racial restrictive covenants, the withholding of capital in the form of bank loans and other things like that, in order to suppress these freedmen's colonies, these freedmen's towns around Austin. So we give the 1929 master plan sometimes as credit for being, or not credit, but the opposite of credit, for being the thing which really changed the racial geography of the city. But that's not the case at all. The African Americans have been attacked from the very beginnings of this city in terms of when they try to found community.
So, John, is there something in writing with this history?
Well, not per se my spin on it there, but there is an excellent book that's written by one of the research librarians at the Austin History Center. And I cannot recall right offhand the name of it, but it documents these freedmen's colonies. What was going on with the various practices that were engaged in by white real estate speculators and just white folks generally, who saw these African American communities as easy places to economically exploit by taking the land and repurposing it for white people. That's not been written. That's something that subsequently I've done a lot of research on that. I've tracked the movement of the African American population through city directories in Austin over the years. And so that's one reason why I happen to be aware of that stuff. And somebody needs to write something on it. I keep saying I'm going to do it, but I don't get around to it.
Yeah, I think that would be really, really helpful, you know, to have that larger history of Austin. And I think it's very helpful to understand how these Freedmen Aryans came about. But it does, as you say, sort of undermine that argument that the 28-29 maneuver was something unusual, that was much more consistent with the history that we were living in.
Yeah. You know, Jim, you know the law far better than anybody, but the 29 Master Plan came about because of the Louisville decision at the Supreme Court, where Louisville had tried, I think it was Louisville, Kentucky, they tried to enact racial zoning, and the Supreme Court struck it down, not for reasons that it was a violation of civil rights or anything, but that for the reason that white landowners ought to be able to sell property. It's similar to the Shelley versus Kramer restrictive covenants case, that white property owners shouldn't be alienated from their property right to sell their land to whoever they want. But when the Supreme Court declared racial zoning to be illegal, and Austin was coming around a little late towards city planning, they used the incentives of public services to be a vehicle for the city to use planning in order to put the final exclamation mark on the attack on the Black community.
That history was very interesting. Like I said, I knew about the Clarksville settlements, and I'd actually heard about the Freedmen's colonies. The Statesman actually does a little history column that I think was just started recently, last couple of years. And there were some blurbs about that that I read about a year and a half ago. That's where I learned some of the history of it. So it was interesting to find out that a large swath of West Campus of UT was once a Freedmen's colony, and there's still a building that exists there too.
Yeah, the Fontaine store.
Yeah.
That's Jacob Fontaine's business that he actually built there. They call it the Franzetti store because it went from Fontaine to Italian immigrants ran a grocery store in Wheatsville, the Franzetti's. But yeah, you know, one of the tools the city of Austin used to eliminate Wheatsville and that whole African-American West Campus settlement was they put the city dump on the neighborhood. Literally, the wagons would come out and dump the white people's refuse in the Wheatsville community. It was none too subtle.
You know, John, I really appreciate the history too. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised given all the commentary people are sharing these days about the lack of awareness of what happened in Tulsa. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that there's gaps in our understanding of history, you know, in our own local communities here. If I could swing forward a little bit, thinking about the process of redlining, and you know, that's sort of the formal name that we now give to what the realtors were doing. I think of that as being a post-World War II phenomenon, but it sounds like it's got its roots even earlier than that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You know, the Freedmen who came to Austin, they could never borrow any money from anybody to buy land or build houses or build churches. They had to finance it with cash. The community in Clarksville, Charles Griffin, there's some question about who was the actual founder of Clarksville in the oral tradition, but he had to get financing from Governor Pease, in essence, who owned the plantation, which had and had a number of slaves, had slave cabins behind him, which still stands over in West Austin. He had to borrow money from the plantation owner to be able to buy land to get the first acreage in Clarksville. So at least that's the oral tradition that I'm aware of. There's a lot of uncertainty about that because there's very few written records other than one deed. So you're financing everything with cash, while the white community, people like the individuals who built Hyde Park or subdivided Travis Heights, were able to go borrow from the banks in Austin money to acquire acreages to provide streets and sewer, and then the public would come in and subsidize the private development by running a streetcar line out to those suburbs and agreeing to take the dedicated streets and maintain them and the like. So the combination of private capital, which was available only to whites, with the public cooperation of the city and the county governments who provided services only to white communities like that, basically magnified the inequality of opportunity to be able to develop communities that were communities of quality, that had services that people were dependent upon. And then you get into the whole thing about the negative stuff that the city and the county would do toward these communities of color. Like, as I said, put a dump in Wheatsville and close down the school in Clarksville and make the kids walk across town to East Austin if they wanted to go to school and the like.
So we fast forward a little bit through that history now. Now we've got the problem of affordability. Can you talk about where you saw that starting through Texas Housers? And this is largely a product of our own design, so to speak. We talk a little bit about what Texas Housers, how they started out addressing that and what it is you do to help bring awareness of that.
You know, I wish I could say that we did enough or a lot to be able to deal with the problem. I mean, Austin's African American community has suffered for so long and so deeply and is so economically disadvantaged. And that economic disadvantage has been magnified over so many years. It's not the type of thing that somebody just goes in and sets up a program and boom, the program is solved. There are large structural problems of economic inequality, which underlie the affordability crisis in Austin. And on top of the general growth of the city, it's really it's really beyond the power of, you know, a handful or even a lot of institutions, nonprofit institutions, to be able to come in and address the problem.
We're speaking with John Henneberger, co-director of Texas Housers, a private nonprofit organization dedicated to providing information about housing and community development issues in Texas. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Hey everybody, this is Lisa Sheps of Offstage and On the Air, reminding you that there is lots of really good live theater here in Austin, Texas. Make sure you check it out when you're able. You're listening to KOOP 91.7 FM, streaming live at koop.org.
Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin, and streaming live at koop.org. I'm your guest host, Michelle Manning-Scott, alongside regular host Bob Daly. This evening's program was homecrafted and recorded on June 10th, 2021. We're speaking with John Henneberger, co-director of Texas Housers, a private nonprofit organization dedicated to providing information about housing and community development issues in Texas. Let's continue.
So the way we go about doing it is to address the affordability crisis. We work with leaders across the state. We're not primarily working in Austin. We're working a lot in Houston, a lot in San Antonio, Corpus Christi. We've been active in Port Arthur, in Lubbock. We're pretty active right now. And what we do is we work with community leaders of color in those communities who've identified a problem that is a significant problem for the local community. It might be an environmental problem where the city has allowed chemical plants to build next door to them. It might be a situation where, like, we're working in the Fifth Ward in Houston in Cashmere Gardens with a community there where the city and the county have never provided any storm sewers. So every time it rains in Houston, and as we know too well, it rains a lot in Houston and sometimes with disastrous consequences, everybody's home floods, yet the city provides storm sewers in white neighborhoods but doesn't provide any storm sewers in most Black neighborhoods in Houston. So we will work with community leaders who want to confront those type of problems. The same way that I started out in 75 working with Clarksville that was trying to fight off a city expressway, that the Crosstown Expressway, which was the city was going to build through the neighborhood. Basically, we are the research arm of community leaders who are challenging government, that when government is either failing to do right by people or is affirmatively doing wrong by people and communities of color. We're not their advocates, we're their assistants. And our staff consists of community and regional planning graduates who know how to look at public databases, to do open records requests, to extract data, to map it in a way that people can use it and understand it. We have attorneys who are knowledgeable about how to use the 1964 Civil Rights Act, Title VI, to challenge the withholding of federal funds or the unequal provision of access to benefits of federal funds. We work with the Fair Housing Act. Fundamentally, we're an organization whose philosophy is based on Dr. King's vision of the beloved community and the idea that an integrated society is the only solution to save us all. And so we believe in the construction of integrated communities and equal opportunity to solve problems. We occasionally get off and propose some things on our own, but we're mostly focused on the problems that are identified by these leaders within these communities and how can we support them.
A couple years ago, we voted on $250 million in a housing bond here. And I think at the time we were all patting ourselves on the back for what a great thing that was going to be. In retrospect, it seems like kind of a drop in the bucket now, but maybe you could comment on that. And if you've got any insights about how that money is being used.
Well, we ought to pat ourselves on the back a little bit about that. I mean, it is not a solution to the problem, but it's more than any other city in this state has done. And there's been a significant increase in Austin voters willing to vote for bonds for affordable housing. The bonds are critically important. It's pretty hard to put a dent in the affordability problem, but we could do better with the bonds. There needs to be better targeting of the way we use the bonds, and there needs to be more leverage of the bonds. We will never finance with bonds our way out of structural racist residential inequality. It has been created over more than 100 years with massive transfers of wealth between whites and Blacks and Hispanics through the real estate industry. And the public sector has an important role to play through those bonds, but it's going to take a lot more resources than the public sector has. I talk about the need for better targeting of the bonds. And, you know, let's say you have $500 million of bonds. That's a paltry drop in the bucket because it's spread across 3 or 4 years. And look at the amount of money that is invested in real estate over 3 or 4 years in this town. And that is an infinitesimally small amount. But it's an important amount, so you need to leverage it. So when you look at the census data, there is a deficit in Austin, Texas today of 52,595 rental housing units that are affordable to what HUD classifies as extremely low-income households. That's households who earn less than 30% of the median family income in Austin. Don't ask me what the numbers are. I'd have to look them up and we'd be here for a long time while I go try to pile through the tables. But, you know, let's say the median family income in Austin is like $75,000-$80,000. So 30% of that and below is the population I'm talking about. So there's already an existing deficit of more than 52,000 rental housing units affordable for that population. The consequence is that the cost of rent in Austin for really poor folks. And there is a high degree of correlation between really low income people and people of color. Not a, a lesser correlation as Austin gets whiter and whiter, but still a very high correlation. So if we're going to do housing justice, racial justice, we're going to have to make housing available for poor people. So there's a category of people called extremely cost burdened households. If you're a renter and you're paying half of your total income for rent or more, you're classified by the federal government as being extremely low income. Well, when you look at who in Austin is paying half or more of their income for rent, 79% of the people in that lowest income category, where there's already a deficit of more than 52,000 units, 79% of those extremely low income households are paying more than half of their income for rent. Now, that's a huge problem. But when we talk about how we're going to spend housing bonds and we talk about the affordable housing crisis, you know, the question we have to ask is, who has the affordable housing crisis? Who are we really talking about here? Because, you know, a lot of people who are higher income people believe they have an affordable housing crisis, but the numbers really don't support that in Austin. 79%, almost 80% of the extremely poor households pay more than half their income for rent. You move up the ladder at above 80% of median family income. The census data says that the percentage of households paying more than 50% of their income is zero. At the income range between 50 and 80% of median family income, which is below that one, the percentage of households who pay more than half of their income for rent is 4%. So the reason why I get into all of this is if you go back and you look at how housing bonds are spent by the city, quite often you will see we are creating units which have rents that are only affordable to people earning 50 or 60 or 80% of median family income. But people earning 60% of median family income, according to the census data, only 4% of them have a 50% rent burden or greater, whereas 79% of the really poor folks have a rent burden. So we got to target the bonds toward the people who are the ones who are suffering in this. And that translates when you look at the housing supply out there. In Austin today, for every 100 extremely low-income households, there are only 23 rental homes affordable to them. Whereas for families earning 80% of median family income or above, the census data says there are 107 units for every 100 families earning 80% or more median family income. I know there's a lot of figures I just threw out. It's really the fundamental question about how we should be spending public money. And let me just say that you can Google National Low Income Housing Coalition, comma, The Gap. This is the national group that publishes the report every year that takes this census data and reports it. And you can get into all the details and understand the subtleties and the complexities of this. It's really not that complex. I haven't done a very good job of explaining it. But the bottom line is, if we're going to make a dent in rental housing, if the bonds are going to be important, we have to target, first of all. The second thing that we have to do is we have to leverage. We have to insist that the development community make a contribution to this solution of this, because we don't have enough public money to be able to solve the problem. And unfortunately, the Texas legislature controls what we do, especially if we live in Austin, and they find ways to undo everything progressive that we manage to get going. I think that a solution to this is to basically trade density, to trade housing density with developers for affordable housing. And we do that to some extent in Austin, but we don't do it very aggressively or very smartly. I believe that what we should do is we should set quotas for every neighborhood in Austin to have a certain percentage of affordable housing within them. You know, I believe that integration is a public purpose. Economic and racial integration is a public purpose. We can't, the legislature won't let us, probably federal law won't let us designate units for people of color. But what we can do legally is we can designate units for lower income people. And there is a strong correlation between income and race. So I would say the city council should start by doing an assessment of affordability neighborhood by neighborhood in this city and establish goals for affordable housing in each neighborhood. And it should say to the neighborhood associations in each of these neighborhoods, if you want stuff from the city, then you need to be willing to grant density bonuses, agreements to accept apartments, agreements to go out and seek funds and develop affordable housing the way minority communities, the way Clarksville and Guadalupe and Blackland, these are all African-American and Hispanic neighborhoods that have created their own community development corporations to build affordable housing. We should have white neighborhoods that are incentivized to build affordable housing in their neighborhoods. You want your new library? Okay, you got to meet your affordable housing goals. You got to show progress in meeting your affordable housing goals. You want to save the municipal golf course, West Austin? Okay, well, make a provision to provide a certain amount of affordable housing in the neighborhood, or the city's not going to back you on that type of stuff.
Maybe we could have that as a goal for the 100th anniversary of the master plan, huh?
I like it.
I think we're getting close to being out of time here, but I'm just wondering if you're seeing a shift citywide, statewide, now that we've had the racial reckoning from last summer. Are you starting to see people coming around a little bit, at least? I think that's a key part of it, is we just went through all this history. People need to be aware. People need to understand, like you've been talking about.
Well, I'm not an expert on public opinion. I can say that when you look at the numbers, we're not going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm just wondering, policy-wise, people you're working with in the community, if you're seeing any kind of shift in thought.
Our city council is better about acknowledging these problems and trying to deal with them than it has been in the past. I don't think they're doing enough. I think the neighborhood goals for affordable housing is, you know, we need something bigger and bolder. We need the bonds. We need more bonds. We need more emphasis on this. But we've got to recognize that the shapers of Austin, the players that have caused Pflugerville to be the highest percentage African-American major city in Texas, all of a sudden over the course of 15 or 20 years, as Austin's African-American community has dropped and basically moved out, that is caused by private market actors. And I specifically point to the Austin Board of Realtors and the Austin Apartment Association, who I think have been completely irresponsible in assuming any leadership role in recognizing the racial impact of what their members do to this city and to the people of color in this city. And I think that the city needs to hold them accountable. You know, we won't tolerate somebody saying something openly racist, but we will tolerate an apartment association whose roots are in the opposition of the Fair Housing Ordinance in 1968 in this city that has created and maintained a rental housing market which does not provide equitably for lower income people and the like, and a real estate industry which has viewed African American communities as basically a colony that they can economically mine in order to enrich mostly white investors to transfer Black property into their hands and into their wealth. You know, we need to call this stuff out. This is racism. And we have institutional racism on the part of the Austin Board of Realtors, the Austin Apartment Association, and the banking community in this town. That's where there needs to be a reckoning. And we are all complicit in acting like what they do is just the way things are done. There needs to be a public outcry.
Yeah.
This has been a really very helpful, informative session.
Yeah, I really appreciate it too, John. I mean, I appreciate the history lesson and just the perspective about where we're at right now.
Let me also suggest to your listeners that if they want to learn more about some of these issues, we have a very extensive website with blog entries on what's going on in Austin and other cities related to these type of issues that can be found at texashousers.org. And the person who's taking my role, I'm pulling back from being the co-director of my organization and going to be a worker within my organization. Christina Rosales is going to take my place in the next month. And she and I host a podcast called A Little Louder, which is a quote from President Johnson when he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1968. He said, "The bell of freedom rings out a little louder." And so our podcast is trying to keep that bell ringing. And we talk about these issues on our podcast that you can get wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Great. Good to know. Thanks for including your website. We appreciate your time. It's been interesting and informative. So thanks again.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, June 11th, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us. Austin Sanders is a staff writer for the Austin Chronicle, covers city council, APD, homelessness, and a variety of other issues. How's it going, Austin?
Oh, I'm doing all right, Bob. Thanks for having me on again.
Sure. Well, it's always good to hear from you. So it sounds like city council met for the last time for the next few weeks to come anyway. Quite a bit about taxes for homes, about relief for homeowners and homeless, I guess. And maybe a little more about sanctioned encampments. I think we've all been reading about this homestead tax. Can you lay that out for us in a manner that's digestible?
Yeah, it is definitely confusing. But basically, taxing entities, the city and the county, they get revenue from property taxes from property owners, and they have the option of exempting certain percentages of a property, a home's value, assessed value, if someone lives in the home, if it's your homestead, you know, if the property owner, if you're living there, you can exempt a certain portion of the home's value that the Travis County Central Appraisal District uses to calculate your property tax bill. So what city council did is they took a final vote yesterday to double that exemption rate from 10% to 20%. So basically, people who live in their home and own their home can take 20% off the value of their taxable value that goes toward their bill. And basically what this translates to is someone who owns a home that's worth about $400,000 will save $141 per year on their property tax bill. And that's from city staff, the numbers that they crunched. Of course, the real estate market has been really explosive, and that is now $400,000 is now on the low end of property values in Austin. Just last month, in April, the Austin Board of Realtors reported that the median sale price for a home was $550,000, so quite a bit above that. But certainly the savings will help people, especially those who are on fixed incomes, who, you know, are subject to rising property tax rates without rising wages or income. So any bit of savings will help, even if it is, you know, $141 a year is not a great tax break for the average homeowner, but it certainly will help people stay in their homes. However, it should be noted that, of course, this is only for homeowners. Renters do not really benefit directly from this property tax exemption, the homestead exemption. It's reasonable to assume that landlords, property owners at multifamily buildings, not multifamily buildings, but other rental properties, will pass along the savings on their property tax bill to rent. But there's no way to really calculate that directly. So at least renters don't benefit directly from the exemption the way that people who own their home do.
Got it. Yeah. And given that more than 50% of the residents of Austin live in rental housing, I think it's probably 55-56% as I last recall.
Yeah. I don't remember the exact figure either, but we are a majority renter city, which advocates point out, including council member Greg Kassar, who voted for the homestead exemption this year, but has opposed it in the past. And that's partly because there's a change in the way the state interprets the tax rules, to where increasing the homestead exemption used to cost cities revenue, so it would be detrimental to other services in exchange for this tax break for homeowners. But that's no longer the case. So it's actually now revenue neutral to the city, which is why the council unanimously supported raising it to the maximum allowed level of 20%.
Got it. Well, then, besides that, is city council made a decision about what to do with somewhere near $100 million worth of federal funding. Is that right?
Yeah. So basically what they did is they voted on a spending framework for about $263 million worth of funding. $188 million of that is from the American Rescue Plan federal stimulus. That's the $1.9 trillion stimulus that the U.S. Congress passed in March. Austin's share of that is $188 million. And about $100 million of that is going to be set aside for homelessness, a variety of responses, permanent housing, services, sheltering, perhaps designated campsites, just a range of uses. It's the largest chunk by far that the city is setting aside for use. It's one of the four priority areas that City Council highlighted for staff, the others being childcare, workforce development, rent relief, and community resilience, which kind of includes nonprofit and creative sector support, arts and music, and these resilience hubs. So those are the areas that council wants to spend this $263 million. And the way that they're envisioning use of these funds is not just one-time usage, but to kind of spur the creation of a stronger social safety net, to basically lay a foundation, especially in regards to homelessness, that can be built upon for years and years to come. You know, so there's going to be a lot of upfront investment that hopefully will help, again, kind of turn into a greater social safety net, social support in the coming years.
This $100 million or so, you say that was approved by City Council?
Yeah, right. And part of the concern that some council members expressed is there's not yet a concrete plan of how that funding should be spent. There are ideas floating around. Staff has suggested some ways that it could be spent. But the goal that was laid out in this summit to end homelessness that was convened by ECHO and city and county leaders and private and philanthropic leaders of housing 3,000 people living on the street within the next 3 years. That's kind of the new North Star for the Austin-Travis County community on homelessness. So they have a goal, but how to get there is the question, right? And of course, there are other competing factors, right? Prop B, we've just entered phase two of enforcement, as APD is calling it, which means people public camping can now get written warnings if they're camping in a place they're not allowed to be. If they have gotten a warning and have not moved, they could be issued a citation, right? Mm-hmm. So we're kind of advancing along the Prop B enforcement schedule. So as Councilmember Kathy Tovo has pointed out repeatedly, the city and the council are kind of caught between wanting to provide the best solution to ending homelessness, which is permanent supportive housing, but that takes a long time to set up. And these quicker solutions like designated campgrounds, converting motels that the city is already leasing or owns into bridge shelter, which will be able to accommodate fewer people, but would be more comfortable living arrangement, to kind of prepare for Prop B. So as Tovo has pointed out, you know, the city is caught between doing what will work best and what can be set up quickly. So that's kind of where staff is at right now. They are going to, while council is not meeting for 6 weeks, staff will work with council offices and with other city departments to kind of say, hey, what's the best way to utilize these funds so that we can quickly help people and provide a place to go, but not at the expense of the longer term, more permanent solutions, right? So as Diana Gray, the homeless strategy officer, put at the meeting last night, timeliness is a really important factor for her. What can be turned around quickly to provide solutions for people who need a place to go immediately?
Right. Well, even though City Council won't be meeting for the next 6 weeks, we'd sure love to have you on with any updates. I know there's several irons in the fire. You mentioned the sanctioned encampments. I know that the city's still looking for a police chief, and who knows what else is going to break loose in the next few weeks.
Yeah, there's still will be a lot of news to cover, despite council not meeting as a whole body for a while.
Well, as always, we really appreciate the update on all this and hope you're doing well.
Yes, same to you, Bob. Thanks again.
That's all from Bob and I this evening. Coming up next, the Doubleheads Variety Hour with DJs Matt and Dylan, a new show here on Co-op that seeks to answer the question, is two actually better than one? Each episode features two separate musical themes, one picked by each DJ, with selections played side by side. Part music discovery, part comedy, and part educational, DHVH is an experiment in genre exploration. Check it out. Have a good evening, everyone.